Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So it hasn't been a good year for the institution of marriage, has it? At least for politicians and their wives.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with a, which started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do.
Innocently? How about willfully? That was South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Why is it always about South Carolina? And here's New Mexico Senator John Ensign with a different sort of explanation.
The woman who was I was involved with and her husband were both close friends, and they both worked for me. Our families were very close. That closeness put me into situations during a very difficult time in my marriage, which led to my inappropriate behavior. We caused deep pain to both families. For that, I'm truly sorry.
John Ensign, and maybe you don't even know about Congressman Chip Pickering yet, but either way, the institution of marriage is taking some blows, and not just for powerful men. Caitlin Flanagan wrote an article in Time magazine earlier this month about people across all economic spectrums and the various ways they're busting out of their marriages, sometimes temporarily, sometimes not. She joins me now to talk about many of the ways that we have as a society forsaken marriage or become ambivalent about the institution. Caitlin Flanagan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
So how are we ambivalent about the institution of marriage? Aren't we as a society obsessed with marriage?
Well, we're very bullish on getting married. You know, if you talk to poor women, you know, very young women who have one or two children and haven't been married and even have two fathers for two children, and you say, so I guess you don't want to get married. Absolutely not. They really want to get married. Their life plan absolutely includes, you know, they just put it in a different order than would be successful, but yeah, they want to have some children. They want to finish their education. They want ultimately to get some kind of home. They dream of buying a house, but at least getting into a better neighborhood. And then the icing on the cake is to marry some Prince Charming. So they're really bullish on marriage. They just have a plan that doesn't really get there very well. And then among more affluent people, middle and upper class women are very rare to have children before they're married. That's a real blip on the radar. They will get married in big white weddings, spend a lot of money on that wedding. But once they're in it, they'll go, oh, this isn't as much fun as I thought, or this is a drag, and they'll get divorced. So you're having this very strange new situation where unlike, you know, 60 years ago, children are floating in and out of a lot of homes that aren't, you know, monitored by the parents that they are, the common children of.
So the ambivalence, is it that we have an ideal of marriage that we all want to live up to and we tend to rush into it or make an imperfect union fit into the fairy tale version we were taught we should try for, and then we get disappointed compared to our expectations?
Our ideal is completely out of whack. You know, marriage for every single person is really hard because life is really hard. And all of the unplanned things that cause suffering to us that unfold over an adult lifetime, whether it's illness, whether it's a job reversal or a reversal of finances because of the economy, whether it's because losing someone you really love who's close to you, all of those things unfold over every adult life, and if you're married, they're going to unfold during the marriage. So you could start out with the best of intentions and be more in love than anyone who's ever gotten married. But then the rubber's going to hit the road, and what are you going to do then? Are these sorrows going to bring you closer? Are they going to build endurance with each other? Or are they going to be used sort of to inflict more pain on one another and bring down the marriage?
We can take a few phone calls for Caitlin Flanagan. Talk about your ambivalence regarding the institution of marriage or how you see it around you. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe you read her article in Time. Maybe you know some of Caitlin Flanagan's other works. Her new book will come out soon called Girl Land. And this article is called Is There Hope for the American Marriage? So what do you think people need to adjust more? Their unrealistic expectations for marriage or their willingness to stay in bad marriages, which is part of what you seem to be saying in your piece?
No, I don't think, you know, there are certain marriages that I think you're, what you're kind of alluding to here is there's been a whole new body of research, pioneering research, a lot of it done actually by women who are not at all conservative women, not at all trying to force some unpalatable idea on the rest of us. But we used to always think that if a middle-class couple got divorced, if they were both really unhappy in the marriage and the children are growing up in this stew of unhappiness, that it would clearly be better for mom and dad's happiness for them to get divorced, and therefore it would clearly be better for the children because instead of having two miserable parents, they have two happy parents. It made perfect sense. It just was something that when no-fault divorce started, you know, going large-scale in the late 70s and early 80s, it made sense to all of us. But a few women, one at Princeton in particular and then one at Harvard, started saying, assuming that they would prove that for middle-class kids there is no long-term effect for divorce, went out and did a lot of research on it, and they found out there's a sleeper effect to divorce. It's true that the dire things you read about in single-mother households, you know, criminality, you know, kids ending up in gangs and more likely to drop out of school, those things really fall on the poor, not on the middle and upper middle classes. But there's a lot of wounding and trauma and long-term effects of divorce even on these middle-class kids.
Is this Caitlin Flanagan's Murphy Brown speech?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, that, as I was saying before, that whole kind of conservative notion that if, you know, single-by-choice mothers in the upper middle class decide, you know, to get pregnant or have a divorce, the whole culture is going to be in trouble. That is the tiniest number. The number of that we need to be concerned about is 39.6% of births to unwed women. Those aren't Murphy Brown. Those are poor women. And as a society, we need to grow up, stop these conservatives from leveraging their agenda on single mothers by choice in the upper income group and say, no, these are very poor girls in desperate situations. They're not doing it for a welfare check. They're not doing it to have a little doll they can dress up. They're doing it because they can't find any other way out of this grinding life of intractable poverty. The only marker of adulthood that seems within reach is having a baby.
So, Caitlin, when's the last time you talked to a wedding DJ?
Not recently, but I'm always available to talk to a wedding DJ.
Like Tony in Fort Lee. Tony, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning, Brian, and good morning, Caitlin.
I'm a wedding DJ
for going on 20 years, and that's what I do for a living. And, yeah, it's amazing how I'll do weddings that it's their second marriage, third marriage, and I guess it's the fantasy that, you know, it'll be maybe better next time around, or, you know, people are in love with being in love, but mm-hmm. as I said to the call screener, I think the key is having a discipline and structure. I would even say maybe having religion in your life possibly. I'm not a holy roller, but I see from my experience.
Let's not get carried away with your expertise here, Tony. You only see them on their wedding days.
Well, but I just got married 2 months ago, too, by the way.
Oh, you did. Congratulations.
Thank you
very
much.
Here's what I want to know from you. Since you've been doing this for 20 years, what changes have you seen in the nature of the first wedding? Are they different?
Yeah, they usually, so far as the party goes, yeah, they're usually at your second and third weddings, they're not as extravagant.
Oh, right, of course. I mean the first wedding. First weddings now compared to first weddings 20 years ago. How are they different?
Yeah, more elaborate, definitely much more money spent. When I first started, I mean, you know, you might go to a local VFW hall or rental hall. Now it's, I mean, if you're not spending in North Jersey, I would say average $100,000 for your wedding in Northern mm-hmm. Jersey. You know, your wedding's considered, I don't know, it's nothing to talk about unless it's a minimum, wedding spent of $100,000, you know, limo and food and photographer, videographer.
Tony, thank you very much. And you played right into my hands because, Caitlin, you think that matters to the success of marriage, don't you?
Well, I think he made a really great point when he said, you know, that as a guy who's on the front line of this huge expensive day, he said, maybe it's discipline, maybe it's structure, maybe it's even religion. And these are sort of the last things you want to think about. I've had one of those huge weddings. And you get so absorbed in the details and the excitement of it. And if someone comes along and says, discipline and structure, like, but I always talk about, I've written about, I had a first marriage that failed. I was very young. I was out of college. It didn't last long. We didn't have children. We had a huge white wedding. And if you had I literally don't think we spent five. I mean, we spent so much time talking about the wedding and the honeymoon. I don't think he and I spent 5 minutes about, well, so what will we do? Will we have children? Will one of us stay home? Will one of us work? Will we send the children to daycare? Will we, you know, do we want to earn money to buy a home? Do we want to sort of stay in a group where we rent apartments and not be such ambitious people? All the sort of huge questions about day-to-day life as a middle-aged and an older person, I don't think we ever asked those. And I think the lost leader of this wedding is really sort of helping people to just say, oh, don't ask the big questions. Don't sit down and gut it out. Don't talk to a religious person if maybe you share the same faith about this. Just jump in with both feet. And 8 or 9 years later, it can look really different than it did when you were, you know, walking down the aisle, for sure.
But the bigness of the wedding represents, and the increasing bigness of the wedding represents an increasing bigness of our idealizing of a fraying institution. Do you want to go that far?
Well, I did write an essay about that once, my first essay I ever wrote, which was that in the olden days, you didn't need to spend a penny to make a wedding a very awesome, in the true sense of the word, event. You had two young people, probably virgins, at least this was the beginning of their public sexual life. And they were making this decision, perhaps foolhardy, perhaps well-intended and well-planned, and they were going to be together the rest of their lives. And they had a small wedding in the bride's front parlor, and there was nothing fancy to eat. There was some punch in a bowl, maybe a cake, maybe some corsages for the two mothers. And tears were shed because you knew when she left that house, she probably was going to have her first sexual experience, probably wasn't going to be especially good. And that she was then going to be with that man through all sorts of things, and if the marriage failed, she'd be left alone. So you didn't have to gild that lily or that, you know, primrose at all. But now you bring together a couple. They've been living together a couple of years. Maybe they've got a prenuptial agreement. Maybe they're each financially independent of the other. And it's sort of saying, but pay attention to us. We really mean for this to last forever. Mm-hmm. Well, you got to put on a pretty big show for me to take interest in that event.
Caitlin Flanagan, my guest on WNYC, talking about her Time Magazine article, Is There Hope for the American Marriage? And Karen in Manhattan can't get into this institution in New York State, and I'm not sure she wants to. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You know, I was just discussing the gay marriage issue, and basically I understand from wanting to have rights to their property and issues like that, but when I was coming out in the 90s, or in the early 90s, I should say, there were just a lot more. Being gay meant you were part of a renegade culture. It was way more sassy. Like, it didn't mean that you were entering into the institution of normativity that marriage is, was traditionally caught up with. And so that became like a really, to me, not fun instance or element of gay society, at least here in New York. And I wonder why so many people want that now, why so many people want social acceptance in this sense.
Defined that way.
What?
Who want full acceptance defined that way.
Yeah, defined that way, especially, I mean, I've also heard arguments that it's something that attorneys really want because gays separate a lot more than heterosexuals,
uh-huh.
And there's going to be a lot more money made there.
Ooh, trial lawyers for gay marriage. That's really interesting. Caitlin, you know, there is an irony here. There's a huge cultural irony, isn't there? As you cite in the article, 40% of children now in America are being born out of wedlock.
To poor women, yeah.
And
these women are poor, yeah.
And middle-class men and women are still getting divorced at astronomical rates.
Yes.
So as gays and lesbians are clamoring to get into this institution, heterosexuals seem to be clamoring to get out.
You know, I've talked to a lot of gay people about this because I know, as a straight woman, I sort of totally can understand where Carol's coming from. You know, we sort of look at the gay culture and go, wow, that's just, you know, there are aspects of it that look really wild and fun, and now all of a sudden these gay people who were the renegades, now they want to, you know, do these boring things like join the military and become Presbyterians and get married. It's like, this is not the best we have to offer you guys. But when I talk to gay people that want to get married, here's what they tell me. They say, as much of a mess as you guys have made of it, We see something of profound value here. We see this notion of committing to really being in love with our partner and to making a public and legal commitment to that person and saying, I'm with you forever till death do us part, and you can always count on me. And so that's why, as sort of a marriage advocate, I'm a little on my own here, but I completely see the gay people who want to get married as our biggest advocates for gay people to say, yes, we see worth in that institution, and we're willing to commit ourselves in that way to partners. That to me is the biggest commercial you could give for the good side of marriage.
Mark in Mount Kisco, we've got about 30 seconds for you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I'm a happily married man of 15 years now. I think that a lot of problem with marriage today is that people, I'm not sure, are designed to be, we're not like geese. We're not designed to be with the same partner for 15 years or for 30 years or for the rest of our life. If you need to sleep with somebody else, you need to discuss that with your partner. And I think that was the problem with all of the senators, is that if they wanted to sleep with somebody else, they needed to discuss that with their partner. I'm still monogamous, or I'm still...
Did you say we're not like
geese?
Pretty much
with my wife, but if at any point I wanted to... I would discuss it with her first.
I didn't know that. Whoa, discuss it with her. And guess what, Caitlin? We have 20.
Extend segment. Get coordinates on Mark.
We have 20 seconds, Caitlin, for you to get a last word on discussing your infidelity before you do it.
Mark, don't do it. It's a slippery slope, Mark.
Mark, you going
to
do it?
If I ever want to, I think I should.
Wow. Mrs. Mark, run, Mrs. Mark.
And that's the last word. Caitlin Flanagan, discussing her Time magazine article, Is There Hope for the American Marriage? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, I don't care who slept with who. I don't care.
It's the Roadside Graves, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.